Now, on these days, a look back at some of the events that took place during this week 50 years ago. Presented by Geoffrey Wheeler. Good evening, and welcome to our look back at some of the events on these days, 50 years ago. The week which began on Monday, the 20th of October, 1947. It was a week of tragedy on the roads and railways. 28 died in the Croydon train crash, and further north, a dramatic coach crash in the mill town of Holmfirth left 8 dead and 26 injured. Also in the news that week, a Cumbria schoolteacher left the classroom to work down the pit. And in Hollywood, the stars gave evidence on un-American activities. 50 years ago, the people of the United Kingdom were digesting news of a disaster that was later to be referred to as the Croydon train crash. 28 people were killed and more than 150 injured in an accident in thick fog near South Croydon station. A Southern Railway electric train ran into the back of another, derailing 4 coaches. Both trains were crowded with people on their way to work. The death toll made the accident the worst on the railways in Britain for 2 years.
As heavy morning fog blanketed southern England, Croydon was the scene of autumn's worst rail disaster. Pathé cameras fly over the rescue work to bring these vivid pictures to the screen. At the peak of the morning rush, 2 trains crowded with city travellers collided. To 29 people came death. Nearly 100 more were injured.
Newspapers the next day recounted the stories of the survivors. One paper described how a group of schoolgirls crawled and jumped from the wreckage. Shaken and dirty, they helped to free trapped passengers. But mindful of their duty as pupils, they then got lifts to school and, after calling home, proceeded to put in a full day in the classroom. Another passenger who survived the Croydon crash was Gwen Allen.
It was a great noise and a really hard impact because I was backing the engine and I finished up almost on the seats opposite, and met the people on that side coming towards me. There was no panic, a really great hush almost. My father, who happened to be nearest the door, opened the door and said, "Well, stay there, I'm going to see what has happened." So he disappeared, and I looked out, and I couldn't see him after 3 or 4 steps because the fog was so thick.
Rescue parties searched the wreckage to free passengers trapped in the telescope carriages. Doctors and ambulance men rushed to the scene from neighbouring districts. Clambering over the debris, they gave first aid.
The frightening part was because I didn't know where we were, what part of the track, the journey we were on. I couldn't remember whether we'd gone through Purley Oaks. And I thought, well, if I get over the fence, where do I go from there? Hadn't a clue where I was. Got out into the road, still not knowing, because you couldn't see. If you did know the road, you wouldn't have recognised it. I started walking, and I noticed that people were coming along in their cars and offering lifts, and somebody pulled up at the side of me and said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, London Bridge or Cannon Street." So he said, "Right, jump in, I'll take you to the one end of London Bridge," which he did.
Firemen led the passengers to safety. Debris was littered all along the line and several carriages disappeared in a tangle of steel frames.
When my father eventually arrived at the office, which was probably well into the early afternoon, I said, "Where have you been all this time?" And he said, "Well, I've been helping to give first aid to people that needed it until the ambulance men arrived." And then I had to go home and change my clothes because they were rather... I had blood on some of them and, you know, the conditions was wet. And, well, he always looked very smart. He wouldn't have come back to the office like that. I did ask him what it was like, you know, were there many people injured? And he said, "Oh, don't ask me. It was just too horrendous."
The death roll is the heaviest in any London rail smash within the past century. It was a sober ending to the week's news.
The Croydon train crash happened just days after the nation was recovering from the shock of another horrifying accident, this time on the roads. 8 people were killed and 26 seriously injured when a bus crashed into a warehouse in the Yorkshire town of Holmfirth. Witnesses said the bus gathered speed as it came down a steep hill into the town. 3 men managed to jump from the moving bus to safety. We knew, one of them said later, that the bus was out of control by the way the driver was fighting the wheel, so we decided to jump for it. The 3 men were exceptionally lucky. The bus careered across the town's crowded Victoria Square before crashing into a warehouse, where it was buried beneath debris. Saturday shoppers and navvies who'd been working on a nearby reservoir rushed to the scene of the accident to help pull rubble away in order to free the trapped passengers. Among those travelling on the bus were singers from the Bolsterstone Male Voice Choir. They were on their way to take part in Holmfirth's first music festival. Tom Cook.
We'd arranged to go to Holmfirth, and we were going to sing a beautiful piece, "Don't Love Could I Only Tell Thee." And we'd really got it off to a fine art. We'd arranged to meet at Bolsterstone. Anyhow, we got up to the Bay Horse pub, and then when you get there, there's a very steep hill down into Holmfirth. It's quite a nasty hill, and we'd only just negotiated the top of the hill when we heard this loud bang at the back, and I was sat at the back, and we looked out of the window, and we could see this great big lump of steel bounding about in the road, and it was a prop shaft, apparently, that had broken. Of course, we were all beginning to get a bit alarmed at that, because something we didn't know exactly what was wrong, and the bus driver didn't seem to heed that, and he just kept going. And then as we started getting faster and faster, we realised that it was getting out of control. Everybody was getting a bit hot under the collar, as you can imagine, when you think a bus is running away. And people were sort of all standing up in the centre of the bus, thinking that if it crashed anywhere, there'd be loads of broken glass and that sort of thing. It was a good way down the hill when one or two other lads had making to jump out under the door. And I think that 4 or 5 of them jumped out. They were doing about 35 miles an hour at that stage. And I was just behind them, and I thought to myself, well, it's going to be too fast for me. So I went back in, and of course that was it. Nobody else jumped off after that. It all seemed to come to an end then. The noise that was going on and all that, and then suddenly there was a deadly silence. The next thing I knew about it was that I was scrambling about on the top of the rubble by myself. And a lady came up to me, and she took me to her house. I can remember that quite vividly. And I could see nothing else except rubble. And of course, I got away with a broken shoulder and various slight injuries.
In October 1947, the country was bracing itself for another winter, with memories of January and February still fresh in people's minds. The emphasis was on coal production, and there was a determination not to repeat the mistakes which led to the fuel crisis. Ernest Bevin was appealing for more miners to go underground to boost the country's production effort. And a schoolteacher from Kendal took his words to heart. Jean Wilson decided to help the country and broaden her experience by taking a week out from her holidays to go down the pit. She worked underground at Hague Pit in Whitehaven for 7 days and put in a shift at the coalface. Her sister, Margaret Atkinson.
I'm not very good at getting up in the mornings, and my husband, he said, you must get up because your sister's in the newspaper. And I thought it was just a con to get me out of bed. But he brought the paper up, and there she was with a miner's helmet, clean white blouse, and black down her cheeks, which they'd put on for the photograph.
Daily Mirror reporter John Checkley.
I then had to find the young lady, which seemed fairly easy to start with because I had an address for her. And when I got there, her father, I think it was, had been a bit angry about what she'd been up to, and she didn't want to talk to anybody. And so she disappeared from home and gone to stay with somebody else. I knew not who it was. So I made a few inquiries about and discovered that she had a sister in Penrith. Trekked up to Penrith, found her house, knocked on the door.
She said, now, if anybody comes, don't let them in. I'm not here. I said, right, promise. I said, yes.
Mrs. Atkinson answered, and she'd been given strict instructions by her sister not to reveal that she was there, but for some unknown reason, whether it was my charm or what, I don't know. But she asked me in.
If I should take a notion to jump into the ocean, take nobody's business if I do, 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 do. Rather than persecute me, choose that you would shoot me, because take nobody's business if I do.
He had the absolutely right attitude, you know, he was very nice. He said he would like to do the story. He explained how he'd got here and did we mind and so on. It was all very correct. And we made him some tea or coffee or something. He suggested that Jean wrote it in her own words. So she sat up in a bedroom and we chatted down here. And then when she'd done a page, she came down and he edited it.
From the Daily Mirror, Wednesday, October the 22nd, 1947.
Exhibitionist, crank, were some of the insults hurled at me when people heard of my plans. But I was happy when the whole thing was arranged and I was bound for Hague Pit, the pit under the sea. I left the green fields of my home for a changed world of drab houses, derelict property, dirty streets, where the men had coal dust in their hair.
She was a very determined, very stubborn-minded lady. I think she was also very keen on doing a good job as a schoolteacher, and she desperately wanted to experience all the things that she was teaching the schoolchildren about, and that is, of course, one of the basic reasons why she went down the mine.
I was taken down the pit clad in overalls with a safety lamp, and as I looked down the deep shaft, some surface workers told me they'd never been down the mine and didn't feel like going. I made my acquaintance with the men between whispers, "Mind your language, yon's a lass." But not all the miners knew I was a girl, and I met many coalface workers, man to man.
You can talk, you can rave, they can say awful things about me. I don't care what you say, go on your way if you doubt me.
I think it never occurred to her that anything sensational would come of it. I mean, that must have been the last thing she thought of. She did like stirring things up, but she didn't really aim at being in the news or anything like that. Just to keep things ticking over nicely and exciting.
Would I go down a mine again? Yes. Girls who are not squeamish could learn much by doing the same. Some men could too, particularly those in striped trousers who talk so much nonsense about the British mines and miners.
Tell nobody's business if I do.
Doing a week down a mine is one way of getting hands-on experience. But in 1947, increasing numbers of people relied on evening classes to broaden their knowledge. With fierce competition for jobs, there was a boom in enrollment at night school. And the Workers' Educational Association passed a resolution during the conference in London expressing grave concern at the way staggered hours in industry would affect attendance at evening classes. They instructed their officers to bring their grievance to the notice of the Ministry of Education as soon as possible. Richard Hoggart was teaching literature at evening classes in the north.
remember that I'd been 5 years in the army and three abroad. I was just out of Italy, and I was given my brief, which was to go and teach literature at Middlesbrough, Redcar, Whitby, Scarborough. There were long distances, these, from my own. And, of course, I was out of touch. In the first weeks, I was driving this sort of five-horsepower car with no heater, with Mansfield Park on my knee. I've got to remind myself of what it was all about. I was on a wing and a prayer for quite a while. So was everybody.
We all loved going to the classes because we looked forward to going, because it did improve our way of life. We all realised that the more we knew, the better it was for us.
It was marvellous in this sense that your classes were always in the evening, and you only did 24 weeks in the year through autumn, winter and spring. So in the morning you settled down and you worked, and the first thing you did was catch up. Well, then when the afternoon came, you sort of went out with your wife and the pram for an hour's fresh air or something. Then you had tea early, and then about five you took off and drove to Scarborough, wherever it was, and there they were in these little school desks very often. And you had an hour, you never talked for an hour, but roughly speaking you had an hour of presentation and then an hour of discussion.
Learning, day by day I'm learning, more and more I'm yearning, just to be with you. I'm learning that you are my one desire. I'm learning that you are the one who's setting my heart on fire.
They varied, of course. You got some retired people who just wanted a nice chat. You persuaded them to write something, but you never got greatly from them. Some of them, they weren't vocational, but one I remember, one of the great successes in that sense, was a motor mechanic in Scarborough, and he really was very clever, but didn't know it. I remember he wrote a complaint for me, which any degree paper would have passed it. He finished his career as on the staff of a higher education college in the Midlands.
They dress up to go to night school because they all like to make an impression. We weren't conscious of it, but it was a little bit of class distinction about it. People thought they were a little catch above everybody else.
On the foreign pages, 50 years ago, there was considerable space devoted to news of the French municipal elections and the victory of General de Gaulle. But another item relating to Paris was attracting attention in the British press, the announcement that Mr. A. Duff Cooper was to relinquish the post of Britain's ambassador to France after 3 years in the job. According to the Daily Telegraph's diplomatic correspondent of the day, Mr. Duff Cooper's resignation had frequently been mooted. The Foreign Secretary, Mr. Bevin, had been coming under considerable pressure from the left to appoint someone to Paris of less aristocratic upbringing and more sympathetic to socialist aspirations.
Duff was an extremely successful ambassador. He was much criticized for consorting with the wrong people in Paris. It was a situation in which it was almost impossible to do the right thing because the beau monde in Paris had been fairly Pétainist in their attitudes in many cases.
Sir Francis Brooks Richards was working in internal French affairs in the British Embassy in Paris.
He had very good personal relations with de Gaulle, which was not an easy thing for any English figure to do. Duff was a curious character. I was very fond of him, but he was very non-20th century. I remember feeling at the time that his mind was very stocked with ideas that belonged to the 18th century, and his style was rather 18th century. Well, he was a small man, his colours rather high, his consumption of alcohol very considerable, He found it very difficult to keep awake after meals, after lunch in particular. And if one had the misfortune to take in somebody whom he found boring to see him after lunch, the eyelids kept on shutting. He was a great stylist, and as a young man working for him, he was very generous, and he used red ink to correct drafts put up to him. And if one managed to get a draft through his hands without him tearing its pieces with red ink, one felt frightfully pleased with oneself. He was very generous in including young people like myself on his staff in the entertaining that went on at the embassy, which was very considerable. Yes, I think he was a very successful ambassador, and Bevan was entirely right to back him. He had great courage. Diana, Lady Diana Cooper, his wife, was a tremendous figure. I mean, she was a great beauty of the day, without any question. Again, tremendously generous. I mean, I remember when my daughter was born, Diana went out with a laundry basket and cut every tulip in an oval bed in front of the front door of their house in Chantilly, and came in to the hospital to call on my wife with the laundry basket full of tulips. It was that sort of gesture. It was very endearing.
I'm just happy in the hands of a girl like you.
In France itself, the news of the municipal elections was matched in newspaper coverage by the announcement that a week-long strike by transport workers had come to an end. The stoppage had paralyzed the country, doing incalculable harm to the economy. The secretary of the Paris Trade Union Groups had issued an ultimatum to the socialist premier, Monsieur Hamadier, and the government gave way on the question of pay for the strike period. Despite the settlement of the transport strike, considerable unrest was still reported among the unions. Dissatisfaction was fueled by the victory in the municipal elections of General de Gaulle.
It started with a quite small union, not affiliated to the communist-dominated CGT. But within a couple of days, the communists decided that they really got to get in on this thing. And it developed to a direct challenge to the government. There's no doubt about it. The government had been intending to negotiate wage deals on the 17th of October and had set up arrangements to that end. But the communists took trouble to disregard this offer and to try to bring everything to a halt in spite of this impending negotiation. And Ramadier came out with a very strong statement, which he made on the 14th. He said, "The decision to strike, taken suddenly 5 days before the municipal election, begins to look like a political maneuver." Then we had the municipal elections, and I've no doubt that the Gaullist Rassemblement benefited very greatly by this mayhem. But of course, voting takes place locally, arrondissement by arrondissement, and therefore the lack of public transport didn't sabotage the elections as such. People went and voted without any question.
In Britain, there was much speculation about what the victory of General de Gaulle would mean for the future of France and of Europe. Correspondents noted that immediately after the victory of his party, the rally of the French people, General de Gaulle called for the dissolution of the National Assembly and for general elections. It seemed clear, in other words, that the big man was firmly back on the center stage of French politics and intended to stay there. The Daily Mail spoke of France
splitting into two definite blocks, de Gaullists and communists, each violently hostile to the other.
The London Evening Standard similarly predicted a return to power of de Gaulle, followed by a clash with the communists, precipitated by a general strike. But the Daily Telegraph interpreted the Gaullist victory in the following way.
"Beyond all question," the Telegraph said, "support for General de Gaulle reflects not some sentimental affection for the symbol of liberation, but a desperate search for economic and political stability. Insofar as he answers this call, he will be able to consolidate and expand what he can rightly regard as an encouraging beginning of a return to the political stage."
in Britain 50 years ago, as in France, the economy and industrial disputes were major items in the news. But in this particular week, there was also a walkout of a very different kind. The girls of the sixth form of Urmston Grammar School in Lancashire walked out of the dining room in a protest at the poor quality of the school meals. Their chief complaints were directed at the mashed potatoes and burned gravy. Marjorie Greenlees was a pupil in the upper fourth at Urmston School at the time of the walkout.
Our sixth form decided that they didn't like the meals. They decided they'd go on strike. But I don't think they liked the cold potatoes and the spaghetti and the lots of other things that we had at that time. The chocolate splosh, which was inevitably squirming about on the plate, and lots of other things like that. I could never understand why they wanted to strike, because I didn't find the food too bad at all. Considering we've just finished with the Second World War, the potato with the blue lumps and, well, rice pudding, tapioca with great big blobs stuck together, it didn't taste that bad, really. I mean, if the blobs didn't stick together, they wouldn't taste any different. They just looked different. And I think a lot of children looked with their eyes and not their tummies at that time, because everything went down mine very quickly indeed. I was so hungry at the time. I was very tall, and they used to call me Daddy Long Legs, but I soon became rather chubby with all the extras I got.
Captain of the hockey team.
And she has Mother to thank for knowing that the fitness essential to all school activities begins with food containing plenty of protein. Generous helpings of Benedict processed peas, rich in vital protein, are her answer to present-day shortages of bodybuilding foods. Benedict processed peas, delicious and nutritious. Remember, Benedict peas contain 18 times as much protein as marrows.
If we had spaghetti with the meat pie, which I adored, I used to say, "Oh, look, the spaghetti just moved," and they'd scream, cover their mouths, and say, "Ooh, I can't eat that." Say, "I can, but you have to give me your meat pie as well." And I used to do this. It was a form of bartering system, because we were not allowed to leave food on our plates. So to pass the scrutiny of the senior mistress, as it was, who actually supervised these meals, I used to even eat that wretched chocolate splosh to get the meat pie. Couldn't get past that, so they were grateful to get rid. I think possibly some of the students in my time were rather well off, and I think their tables were rather filled better than ours, and I think possibly they just couldn't endure this. They were coming and possibly a much better breakfast than we had, and going home to a good meal, whereas with some of us it was the only meal we got of any substance.
Another protest, this time one that turned out to be a big flop. An unofficial rally had been planned at Hyde Park for motorists protesting against the abolition of the basic petrol ration. 10,000 cars had been expected, but in the end, only about 500 motorists turned up, and elaborate police plans to deal with the expected massive disruption to the centre of London were not needed.
Hundreds of motorists went to London's Hyde Park to protest against the abolition of the basic petrol ration. 10,000 were expected, but only 500 turned up. The majority probably ran out of their last basic gallon on the way.
From the London Evening Standard, Thursday, October the 23rd, 1947.
The big rally of the Give Us Back Our Basic motorists in Hyde Park this afternoon was a flop. 10,000 cars had been expected, only about 250 turned up. For more than 4 hours, police had stood by, prepared to deal with thousands of cars converging on London from all over the country. an official from the rally complained that someone had misdirected the motorists.
There seems to be some confusion. Motorists seem to be going round and around the park, and some of them seem to be going out again.
Their claim is that the £5 million saving involved in the cut will result in a loss of production and incentive. Emphasizing that point, motor industrialist Sir Miles Thomas told the demonstrators,
"The situation has materially changed since the ill-advised decision to abolish entirely the basic ration. Coal output is going up."
As the principal speaker, Sir Miles Thomas, began to speak, the Horden Colliery Band of the National Coal Board struck up with "All the King's Horses and All the King's Men." The 340 in the crowd had to huddle close to the loudspeakers to catch what was said.
"It's the men of movement, the little reform. What they're doing by being given at least some petrol to get on with. You know, what we need to inspire production these days are the incentives of civilization and not unnecessary restrictions that only create spivilization.
I guess I'll get the papers and go home like I've been doing ever since we've been apart. I get some consolation when I read of someone else's lonely heart. I wonder if you get the papers too, and if you feel as melancholy as I do. Until you're in my arms again, never more to roam, I guess I'll get the papers and go home."
A reminder that you're listening to our review of events on these days, 50 years ago, in the week which began on Monday, the 20th of October, 1947. The state opening of Parliament on October the 21st was, as always, an occasion of pomp and ceremony. But even though 2 years had passed since the end of the war, the shadow of the conflict still hung over the event. As one correspondent reported, befitting the times, the wartime note of austerity again dimmed the splendours of the state opening.
"And there, to the cheers of the crowd, the salutes of the guard, the ringing of the national anthem, passes the royal procession, Her Majesty sitting on the right-hand side in turquoise blue, the King at her side in the uniform of Admiral of the Fleet, behind them Princess Elizabeth in the glass coach. And the two coaches making suddenly, in this grey and foggy and cold morning, a sudden splash of scarlet and gold as they came into sight and trotted past, and now have disappeared again into the curtain of grey that lies across the entrance to the Victoria Tower."
From the London Evening Standard, Tuesday, October the 21st, 1947.
"Princess Elizabeth, attending her first state opening of Parliament, walked alone behind the King and Queen when they entered the chamber of the House of Lords just before 11 o'clock. She wore a long-skirted dress of dusty pink crepe with a V-neck and little turned-back lapels and half-sleeves, elbow-length pink kid gloves, a halo hat with pink feathers, pink shoes, and she carried a pink bag."
It was certain that the new session would be controversial. Although the government had soft-pedalled on steel nationalisation, the gas industry was due for public ownership. An autumn budget was also listed.
The speech from the throne dealt first with the economic crisis. The King said,
"The nation is faced with grave economic difficulties which affect almost the entire world. My government is determined to use every means in its power to overcome these difficulties. I am confident that in these times of hardship, my people will demonstrate once again to the world their qualities of resolution and energy."
The announcement by the King that the powers of the House of Lords were to be curbed came as a surprise. It could mean that the government, from a tactical point of view, were preparing to go to the country on a slogan of peers versus the people. At present, the Lords can hold up all legislation except money bills for 2 years. As the King indicated the proposals of the government, the people had plenty to talk about.
And along with the state's opening of Parliament, Londoners had a chance during the week to enjoy another celebration rooted in the history of this country. The occasion was the 142nd anniversary of the Battle of Trafalgar. As the crowds gathered in Trafalgar Square for the annual ceremony, they witnessed one break with tradition. For the first time, a young sea cadet took part in the reading of Nelson's Prayer. The prayer had normally been read by a senior member of the Admiralty, but this time William Hicks, aged just 15, stood on the steps of Nelson's Column and spoke the great words of the hero of Trafalgar. William Hicks' sister, Connie Hill.
The family were surprised because the prayer always having been read by a distinguished officer to then come down to a young boy of 15 who had not that much experience of life, and we had never been in that position of being with dignitaries or anybody famous, and sort of a rear admiral or an admiral was a celebrity to us. I can remember the day was very cold. I didn't have any stockings on that day, and peep-toe shoes, trying to be fashionable. But I can remember I froze while I was standing there. But he wore his cadet uniform, not very smart, amongst all the other admirals in their uniforms with all their gold braid. He didn't sound nervous when he read the prayer. He obviously had practiced, but no, he didn't sound nervous. You do feel a bit of nervousness when you stand there and you watch one of your own family. You want them to do well. You don't want them to make any mistakes, but he didn't.
May the great God, whom I worship, grant to my country, and for the benefit of Europe in general, a great and glorious victory. And may no misconduct in anyone tarnish it. And may humanity, after victory, be the predominant feature in the British fleet. For myself, individually, I commit my life to him who made me, and may his blessing light upon my endeavours for serving my country faithfully. To him, I resign myself and the just cause which is entrusted to me to defend. Amen. Amen. Amen.
After the service was over and the few people that were there, it was quite a few people at the foot of the column, had moved away. My mother and my father, walked towards him, and he was standing. He was only a small chap for 15, and obviously the admirals were a lot taller than him, and the look on his face, don't come and talk to me, don't come and talk to anybody. But we wouldn't have done anyway, because we were sort of shy people. My father wouldn't have gone up and spoken to an admiral. He would probably have just gone up and said, "Well done, son."
A cause for public concern 50 years ago, even so soon after the defeat of the Nazis and European fascism, was the continuing increase in the number of fascist meetings in London and the anti-Semitic speeches made at them. Edward Geoffrey Ham, described as the director of policy of the British League of Ex-Servicemen and Women, was bound over for 12 months at North London Magistrates Court on a charge of using insulting language at a public meeting at Ridley Road in Dalston the previous month. The magistrate said he didn't think he would be justified in barring him from speaking in Ridley Road. However, he did warn Ham to be more careful and discriminating in the future. Maurice Beckman was one of the founder members of the 43 Group, who were formed as an anti-fascist organisation.
Geoffrey Ham had been born in Wales. He was a very tall, thin, slim man. He was blonde with a early days blonde moustache, intelligent man. He'd been a school teacher. He joined the Moses Fascist Party pre-war. He became one of Moses' right-hand men. He was very anti-Semitic, excellent speaker. He was interned, and he was actually sent to the Falkland Islands. Then he came back, rejoined Moseley. He is a man who actually always was loyal to Moseley, even until the day Moseley died. He was his personal secretary after the war. He had that disease, anti-Semitism, which was his problem. He was quite brave. I think we put him into hospital at least 5 times, but he kept coming back. Ridley Road actually was a battleground. It really was. 3 battles a week there in Ridley Road. The fascists were holding 36 scheduled weekly meetings in London alone every week. And they were a hard nut to crack at first. But what astonished us, and we couldn't believe it, was that we were coming back to the same fascists and the same anti-Semitism that we had encountered before the war with Moseley and his British Union of Fascists. Fellows were coming in saying, "I've just seen a fascist meeting." And if at one of these meetings where a fascist like Jeffrey Ham, who had been interned as an enemy of the state, was speaking, if somebody in the audience complained or heckled, even if he was still in uniform, the police would arrest him for causing a breach of the peace or public disorder, but not the fascist who was speaking on the platform. Because, after all, in this country, you have free speech, which, of course, is necessary, and I'm all for it. But there must be limits to what people can say. The speaker, on the other hand, who was saying things like, "Not enough Jews were burnt at Belsen, we fought the wrong people," etc. so forth, was allowed to continue speaking. Unbelievable. And it happened in London, and no other country in the world had an emergent post-war fascist organization. None.
In the United States, the targets of official investigation were not fascists, rather those somewhere towards the other end of the political spectrum, communists. And specifically, the focus was on Hollywood, alleged, at the time, to be the main center of communist activity. As a result, the hearings of the U.S. Congress on un-American activities were pervaded by a sense of glamour as the movie stars arrived for questioning. 14 newsreel cameras recorded the hearings, and flashbulbs lit up the room as dozens of photographers fought to get the best pictures. Crowds of people packed the committee room, and spectators jostled on the pavements outside, trying to catch a glimpse as Robert Taylor and Adolphe Monjou arrived to give their testimony.
Appointed by Congress to investigate, Chairman Parnell Thomas opens the hearings.
Investigating alleged communist influence and infiltration in the moving picture industry must not be considered or interpreted as an attack on the industry itself.
First witness, Jack Warner, Vice President of Warner Brothers, said his company had been plagued by writers who tried to put into their scripts
certain things which, in my opinion, are un-American.
But he refused to call them communists.
"I've never seen a communist, and I wouldn't know one if I saw one,"
he declared.
The first of the screen stars to testify before the Committee on Un-American Activities is veteran actor Adolphe Monjou. Once known as the screen's best-dressed man, he states,
"The Communist Party in the United States should be outlawed by the Congress of the United States. It is not a political party. It's a conspiracy to take over our government by force."
Mr. Adolphe Monjou, the film actor, has described Hollywood as a hotbed of un-American, anti-capitalistic, anti-free enterprise activities, it was revealed in Washington. He also stated that it was one of the main centers of communist activity in America. He looked excessively French and wore the insignia of the Légion d'Honneur in his buttonhole and a Bond Street hat.
The court is packed with fashionably dressed women as witness Robert Taylor takes the stand.
Robert Taylor appealed to admiring congressmen for new laws to help Hollywood get rid of its communists. Cameras whirred, congressmen beamed, and a full house of 400 breathless film fans cheered as the leading man of the probe into Movieland Reds strode into the courthouse.
In answer to a committee question on whether the Communist Party should be outlawed in America, Mr. Taylor replies,
"I personally certainly do believe that the Communist Party should be outlawed. However, I'm not an expert on politics or of what the reaction would be. If I had my way about it, they'd all be sent back to Russia or some other unpleasant place."
Extra thousands of swooning autograph hounds, typists, shop girls and housewives milled in the streets outside blocking the traffic.
Next on the list of witnesses is Ronald Reagan, who says,
I will be frank with you that as a citizen, I would not like to see any political party outlawed on the basis of its political ideology. But at the same time, I never, as a citizen, want to see our country become so urged by either fear or resentment of this group that we ever compromise with any of our democratic principles through that fear or resentment.
But we agree with that.
I still think that democracy can do it.
We agree with that. We agree with that.
Thank you very much.
While a witch hunt for communists was gathering steam in the United States, Europe was still coping with many of the social and economic consequences of the war. For thousands of people made homeless during the conflict, there was still no prospect of a new settled life. They had no choice but to await their fate in displaced persons' camps. But there was good news this week, 50 years ago, for 1,000 children from one of the camps in Europe who were being found homes in Canada. In fact, the first batch of 45 children had already gone to stay with Toronto families. Georgine Alabaster was an East German refugee who worked at a camp in Denmark.
I left my family because they would never have got out. The Russians were too close. So I've had to make up my mind very quickly and packed a rucksack, got my bike, and at 7 o'clock at night said my farewells to my parents and left. So after escaping, I ended up in this refugees camp in the middle of Jutland, a big aerodrome in Denmark. The Danish authorities then gathered all the German refugees together in larger camps because it was easier for the administrative purposes. It was a huge operation. Very few people realized it. There were 250,000 of German refugees in Denmark. You had to accept it. There you were. You couldn't move anywhere. You were interned. There was barbed wire around the fence. And there were guards at the entrance of the camp, so nobody could go in or out without going through the guards. Early in 1947, I had been asked by our matron to take over an orphanage. Of course, it was a very useful work to do, because children have to be taken care of, and in the cramped conditions in a camp, whilst you have made friends, you can't suddenly expect a group of people to look after a child that belongs to you. After the experience that people had, of course, children were very precious.
Problems of homelessness were not just affecting former citizens of countries of mainland Europe in the years after the war. Shortages of housing were also causing suffering in Britain. And yet, this week in 1947, the Housing Ministry announced a halt to the building programme. The 260,000 houses being built, and the 90,000 under contract, the ministry said, would be finished. But by 1949, the programme would be cut. Instead, preference would be given to factories in development areas where there was a surplus of labour. Michael Foote was a labour backbencher.
Right from the end of the war, for many of us, housing was absolutely number one question. So we had to get ahead and produce the houses as quickly as possible. Now, Aaron Bevan is in charge of the programme at the Ministry of Health, and he understood that as well as anybody. But he had to try and get the thing moving at a time when builders were all scattered all over the world in the forces and the rest. It was a terribly difficult thing to get started again. But then along came the pressures for the cuts, and the figure had to be cut back they said, had to be done as part of the capital budget that was ordered from the centre. Well, for Nairn Bevan and for us, who were engaged in the housing programme and were interested in the housing question, it was a terrible blow, and it was very difficult to resist, because the case for building other things was very strong too. When the calculation was made that we would build fewer houses than we thought was we could do, Nairn Bevan said, I'm not going to build houses that are not much good, because these people are going to live there for 20, 30 years ahead. And it was a real fight to get more houses, but to keep better houses too. And so when the cut in the housing program came, some of us thought very fierce, but of course we knew some of the reasons why it was happening.
The autumn of 1947 saw an increase in the numbers of itinerant people. The traditional romantic figure of the carefree tramp, roaming the country lanes and living off the land, was being joined by a sight that is still depressingly common on our streets today, that of younger men wandering in search of work. This generation of new tramps, 50 years ago, was made up largely of young men recently demobbed, who were finding it impossible to return to a routine. Restless and discontented, they preferred a life on the open road.
In those days, of course, we had ricks in the fields, and the tramps would use the ricks to sleep in. They'd pull a piece out and get themselves in and make themselves comfortable, but they were certainly not welcome in the village.
The tramp that used to call at the house, he appeared to be stocky built, but I'm not sure he was, because he wore so many clothes, it was very difficult to see how broad he actually was. He had a weather-beaten face, long hair, because it was never cut.
They'd invariably got beards, long beards. I always remember they'd got macks on, long, sort of gabardine macks on, but they were filthy, and they were smelly.
The weather's getting fine, the coffee tastes like wine, you happy hobo, sing hallelujah, I'm a tramp again. Why work away for well, when you can travel for your health, it's spring, you hobo, sing hallelujah, I'm a tramp again.
And he'd had at one time rosy cheeks, but now the veins had gone spider webbish all over him, and he had yellow teeth. The thing I really remember about was his yellow teeth. The teeth looked evil. He was very pleasant. He wore shoes, no polish, never been polished. And for laces, he had farm string on them.
You also noticed in 1947 there was quite a few that were relatively young men. And I remember Mother saying that they were men that had returned from the war, and they couldn't find jobs, so they went on the road. They always seemed to know which houses they could go to. But my mother always made them welcome. She had got a tin mug which she kept for the purpose, and they would come and they'd sit down under the kitchen window, and she'd make them a hot cup of tea and give them a doorstep of bread and dripping.
And he used to come always in the spring and then later in October. And his story was all the same. He had sausage, and would my grandmother fry it for him, which my grandmother always refused, and then proceeded to give him sausage, egg, bacon, anything else that was in the house, and fried bread. He really loved fried bread, and a big pint mug of tea. Now, he never came into the house. He would never have been allowed in, because my mother always said he cannot come in because he's got a lot of fleas and he's not very clean. However, he never attempted to come in. He was always polite.
She always gave them something, because she always had the philosophy that if you treated them with respect, they treated you with respect.
In the world of sport, there was enormous excitement in Europe and the United States last month as golfers from the two regions arrived in Spain for the Ryder Cup. In 1947, it was the turn of the British to take on the Americans on their own soil, in Portland. Captain Henry Cotton and the rest of the team boarded the Queen Mary for the voyage across the Atlantic. Golfer Max Faulkner.
We travelled over on a Queen Mary first class, and it was a wonderful trip. We'd only been out of the services 6 years of the war, and we'd only been out a year, and most of our team were in the service. and this was a wonderful holiday. I never had such a trip in my life. And Arthur Lees was with us, and we had a wonderful time going over to New York. It got a bit rough here and there, and they had to put the ropes up because we touched a bit of a hurricane. And I was in a cabin with Arthur Lees, and he didn't like the sea trip too much. He was stayed in his cabin, I know, for 2 days at least without moving. And he was terrified of the creaking of the ship when it turned sideways, rolled over slowly, took a minute or two to go one way, and the superstructure would creak. And he said, "This bloody thing's going to break in half."
Someone's rocking my dream boat. Someone's invading my dreams. We were sailing along, peaceful and calm. Suddenly something went wrong.
We got into New York. We went to the Waldorf Hotel, the best hotel in New York. Wonderful place. And the next day we had a rest. Then we went to Wing Foot Golf Club, and we went out and a lot of them played. And then we went back on the train that night, and took us about 2 nights, 3 days travelling to get to Portland, Oregon. And we were late, and I said to the press when we got there, they said, "Gee, why are you so late?" I said, "Well, there was a lot of buffalo on the line back there." He said, "That's held us up." Well, I never saw a buffalo in my life, but it was a bit of a joke, and they had it in the headlines in the paper the next day.
Days is presented by Geoffrey Wheeler. The readers are Jimmy Hibbert and Delia Corrie. On These Days was produced in Manchester by Angela Sherwin. The series editor is Lindsay Leonard.